Are you ready, kids? Get your parents' permission, check your mailbox, and grab your shopping cart. It's time for the Adventures in Collecting podcast.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Dave.
Welcome to Adventures in collecting,
where we talk toy news, culture, and hauls,
along with our journeys as collectors.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Adventures in Collecting.
Welcome back, everybody.
We're back. We're back, and we're back with another episode, Dave. It feels like it's becoming the regular thing that we don't have to bury the lead anymore.
Yeah, there's just not necessary. Just assume that there's a lead we're not burying.
Yeah, the interview episodes used to be the special ones, and now it seems like the episodes where it's just you and I are are quickly becoming the one-off episode. So, you know, of course, if you're here, you probably read the description for the episode, but Mego is a toy company with a long history, having created countless iconic toys representing a multitude of properties going all the way back to 1954. Joining us today, along with friend of the pod, Kenneth Siemens from Think Threefold, we have Dr. Mego himself, Paul Clark, and we have the father of modern action figures himself. We have Marty Abrams. Marty, Paul, Kenneth, welcome to Adventures in Collecting.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
So, Marty, before we kind of dig into the meat of all of the fun things that we want to ask you, we ask all of our guests before we get started. And you know what, Marty and Paul, this one is for both of you. You guys can both answer it. Kenneth answered it last time. But what are you guys collecting right now?
On a personal level, for me, I'm collecting relationships. I've gotten to the point in my life that material things don't mean a whole lot, but people do. And having said that, you know, you get to that point where you want to know and meet new people with new ideas, new thoughts, new experiences, and that to me is a full-time chore. And it, even in COVID, in this time where you have limited ability to get out to reach out and touch someone, for me, the reality check is doing things like this, meeting you guys, getting out and talking on other podcast shows, interviews all over the world, by the way. I'm talking about where we've reached out to folks in China, in Europe. And that, to me, is the most rewarding part of what we're doing now.
Awesome. Well, consider us collected. You've collected us.
Yes.
We got a pin you on the wall. I've got a magnet doodle here hanging up in my toy room, and I'm going to write your name on it.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Keep us mint on card, please.
Absolutely. You have no idea how prophetic that is.
And Paul, what about you? What are you collecting?
Oh, I'm collecting all the new Migos that we're making.
There it is.
Excellent.
Awesome. So, you know, when people think of, I feel like when people think of Mego toys starting out, they think of, you know, the 8-inch figures and also the larger ones, the 14-inch figures that you guys have been making since the 1970s. But prior to that, what kind of toys did the company produce?
All companies start in a micro way. You start off with a small idea, and if that works at some level, it's built upon. And my mom and dad started this company back, as you said, back in 1954. And in that time, literally, if you could get toys, forget about creating great stuff. If you could get them, they sold. Because you know, you're talking, it's after World War II or after the Korean War. There's a shortage on everything across the board. And no one's really doing branded stuff. So they were bringing in stuff from Japan, cars and trucks and dolls, all you know, very commodity type product. You know, you talk about mint in box or mint in card. I mean, the original packaging was a corrugated box with maybe a lithographic printed cover. Forget about how the packaging is done today. So that was the aspect of what they were doing. And everybody was doing basically the same thing. If they brought in a fire engine, obviously the red is what everybody preferred. But if he wasn't exclusive, maybe you got it in blue or you got it in green. And that was the aspect of what my folks were doing prior to that. When I came aboard, you know, I came out of NYU with a marketing degree. And the first couple of years I saw the paint, you know, the writing on the wall, that we were just selling price because we had the same product that virtually everybody else had with a very little bit of a nuance here, a bell here or a whistle there. So everything became price. I knew we had to go out and brand that product that we were doing. And at that time, to put stuff on television was very, very expensive. The way down that brandy road for me became licensing. And that's how that actually opened up. I was a kid back in 1968 and just about watching the New York Jets as Joe Namath wins the Super Bowl the next year. And we ran to each other over the course of a year in New York. He was the same age as I am, going to the same clubs. And it became a perfect segue for me to turn around and do my first license, which was the Joe Namath action figure. And that's how we got, really how we got into it. I knew that was the path that we had to take.
So what other inspirations were there to make the kind of action figure you started producing when you took over for your father in 1971?
Here's what I knew. I knew that because we did the Joe Namath action figure, and literally when we all ramped up to release the product, having a looking forward to the Christmas sale, he turns around, plays a preseason game. Guy was a great athlete. Someone intercepted his pass. He goes down to turn around and tackle them in a preseason game. That's what kind of a competitor he was. And he blows out his knee. By blowing out his knee, he blows out the season. By blowing out the season, it blows out the whole product. I knew from that point on we better get into inanimate characters in terms of that aspect. So that was my segue into getting into the action figure area, but into an inanimate objects, whether it be comic books, whether it be television, whether it be movies, and my first venture was because G.I. Joe at that time was a highly successful product in the marketplace and in that area that I had the affinity for. We turned around, we created a brand called Action Jacks, which, by the way, was, you know, a reduced version in size of a G.I. Joe, so we could reduce the cost dramatically. And then we could turn around and build an environment around it that you couldn't actually do a Joe because of scale. Because if you scaled up a Jeep or a tank, or a battle wagon, they were huge, and they were too costly for that time in terms of the cost of plastic and the pricing of the marketplace. But on an 8-inch action figure, that scale comes way, way down, and you can create the motorcycles and the vehicles and the environments that work. And so we went to the marketplace with Action Jackson. We had an incredible reception with the product line. We put it in the market, and it starts to really hum and take off. Then again, you know, we were kids. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. And we created these incredible commercials. They were all animated. First time, because what we were trying to accomplish with the brand. And the National Association of Broadcasters at that time said, you cannot have animated commercials selling to children under the age, I think that time was 8 or 9 or 10. So all our commercials got pulled. So not having from having this great year, we went to having what we call a flat year. It was a good year. We survived, but it wasn't anywhere near the dimension that we thought we would have. And so we knew we had to expand that brand and expand it fast. And so from that next step was into licensing. And we were looking for a brand that would work. And the first brand that came into our shop that we took a hold of was Batman. Now, Batman wasn't just Batman. It was Robin. It was the Joker, you know, the Riddler, Miserplex, all the characters, Superman. So having said that, and knowing that was the place, what we did was because of price, again, because of price point and because of collectability, we stayed the exact same size as Action Jackson. Rather than going to a 12-inch figure that was Joe, which we knew that going under the marketplace and being priced at half the price of G.I. Joe and having a brand like that. And by the way, in those days, brands only paid 5% royalties, not like they are today in the 15 to 16% range for places like Marvel or Lucas. And so we were just, you know, humming. The minute that brand launched, it exploded off the shelf. And, you know, we had the entire DC library. It didn't take a genius to figure out if you had DC, you should have Marvel, because they had the aligning characters, you know, the Hulk and Spider-Man and Iron Man, Black Panther. So we turned around, obviously, we went immediately to get that brand. So the brand just fell into place based upon a history of our involvement from Joe Namath, and from Joe Namath to Action Jackson, and from Action Jackson to Batman, and then to Spider-Man, the Marvel group, as well as the DC group.
Now, see, the thing that I think is really interesting about the Mego figures, and again, you know, because of my age, I and, you know, we'll get into the kind of later history of the company as we go on, but I kind of missed the initial wave of you know, Mego figures. It isn't until, you know, quite literally a few weeks ago that I got my hands on a Mego figure for the first time. I've known about them, you know, known the history and everything. And one of the things that I found kind of mind-blowing about the figure, and something that I kind of always had an association with particularly with 3 3/4-inch G.I. Joes is the actual action figure system itself, with like the O-rings and the, you know, the hooks and like the fact that there's those bands going through them. How did you guys initially go with that kind of design style when you picked the 8-inch scale?
Well, we have a whole engineering group over in Hong Kong. There were other figures that were being made out of other materials that were not the same quality that we wanted to make. But in that adaption portion, became an involvement from a point A to point B to point C until we came up with what we wanted to do. We used Joe as a standard, as a product. We wanted to have the same quality and feel as the 12-inch G.I. Joe, but we wanted to be able to do it at a much lower price point, but have the same quality. And by having the costumes that we were already making on it, with it, we were that one step ahead, because the G.I. Joe basically had the same costume and every one of its characters. Their strategy was then to sell additional costumes to dress, undress the characters, which is really not a male play pattern. It's a female play pattern. The male play pattern is to take $1 in one hand and $1 in the other hand and smack the daylights out of them. and so that was the response of how we operated. One thing we also knew is that when we went out and started to acquire brands, we had to be first to market. It wasn't just getting the brands, it was getting the brands in and getting the brands out quickly. Now, the only way to do that was to standardize the bodies. So we turned around and had basically two sizes of bodies. We had a 14-inch and we had an 18-inch. At that time, I think it was 12-inch, but we've increased the size in the next go-round. But all those bodies were standardized. So all we're really talking about doing is sculpting the head and doing cut and sew, putting a body on it. That allowed us to get to the marketplace literally in 90 days.
Wow.
Because to sculpt the head and to build a rotational mold, maximum from sculpting to finished tooling is 60 days. So if you're going down that road, and that includes what they call the painting mask, so you can paint the eyes and the mouth and the eyebrows and that stuff. But if you're going down that road, simultaneously you're building the costumes, and since it's all the same body, the patterns were basically the same. I mean, you know, you got maybe Shazam is red, and Superman is blue, and Batman is black, but you look at those patterns, the patterns to make the costumes, we're all basically the same. So the cut and sew part became really the expertise of our factories, that we could reduce them that quickly, and we were not tied down by unique and difficult patterns and or super tight printing on our costumes that would take additional time. So we could turn this, we turned very, very fast. And that was one of our selling points to our licensors. You give us the product now and you'll be making royalties for Christmas. And that's why, with all intents and purposes, everybody fell into place with what we were doing. And by the way, when you talk about the G.I. Joe three-quarter inch figure, or you're talking about the Star Wars 3¾-inch figure, that standard is a standard that we started at MIGO, because what happened, I think it was 1974, there was a major oil crisis. And oil and plastic comes out of oil, and the plastic prices literally doubled overnight. And we thought, based upon the pricing that we were going to have, we would have to turn around and raise our prices so on the 8-inch figure, it would damage the retail pricing, it would cut into our volume. So we went. That's when we went down to the 3¾ inch size. We created a brand called the Comic Action Superheroes, they're much smaller. But it was all basically labor versus plastic, and having. So we established another size. So we had the 3¾ inch size, we had the 8-inch size, we then had the 12-inch size, and then we had a bigger size as well. For just to give us the balance of price points and capture retail space.
Now, we've talked about the licenses, DC, Marvel, Kiss is another one that is really a kind of famous MIGO license. Just kind of prove that all properties can be toyetic. How did you go about selecting some of those licenses? And were there any challenges or properties that were a little bit difficult to work with?
Nobody was really difficult to work with. And KISS was probably the easiest to work with, because they had zero licensing base when we went after the license. It wasn't like everybody was banging on their door to go take these crazy musicians who were dressed up in costume and create a license for them. Certainly not in the action figure business. They may have had some, and I don't even think they had that, because I think we were really the foundation of their whole licensing program. But what happened was again, because I was so young and at that time when I was doing all this, I had young kids, and they literally walked me through a lot of this stuff and got me into that, what we call that curve. It's almost like talking about these relationships, like collect relationships. Collecting relationships is collecting experiences, and that's something that you can't replace. So my son at that time, I think it was maybe 6 or 7, he said to me, "Dad, I want to go to a KISS concert." I said, "That's great. What is KISS?" I was clueless. I mean, I had no idea what KISS was. He said, "No, they're a big rock band." I said, "What do you know about rock band?" "Oh, because they wear these crazy costumes." They had touched a chord for the younger male, and I'm talking about the 6 to 10 year old. He might have been 10, by the way. He was 10. Paul's telling me he was 10. Thank you, Paul. When I walked into Madison Square Garden, it was just him and I. His mother didn't go. What I saw was 20,000 people. Half of them were fathers and half of them were 10-year-olds. They were all there. Whoa, what am I missing? And by the way, that's what triggered some of the offbeat stuff that we did over the course of the years. And the minute I walked out of there, the next morning, I was on the phone to their management. And it was like, we literally made that contract with them probably in 20 minutes. Because they were looking for me before I was looking for them. They just didn't know who me was. Me could have been Mattel, me could have been, at that time, could have been Hasbro, could have been Remco, could have been Transigram. I mean, those are the companies that existed at that day. Me could have been Kenna. Me could have been anybody, but they couldn't find me. I walked into their door.
And it's such an iconic commercial too, that original Kiss doll commercial. Like I could think of the jingle.
Kiss, that's the name. Kiss, yep. The totally insane. Kiss, if rocks your game, it's Kiss.
There we go.
That's why he's here.
Yeah, and I mean, they're literally, not even figuratively, I mean, they're superhero rock stars. I mean, does it get more toyetic than a guy that calls himself the Demon, has an extremely long tongue and, you know, an axe for a bass guitar.
And wings.
Kenneth, we're going to make it a point anytime you're on where you have to talk about Kiss at least once. It's going to be an ongoing theme for you.
Thank you.
So, 2018 saw the relaunch of the Mego brand after being absent from the market for about three decades. How did you determine that that was the right time, that the world was ready for Mego again?
What we don't know, and I'll give you a little update, is how many years ago did we do Star Trek?
Original Star Trek?
Not the original, but what you and I did.
Oh, that was 2007.
All right, 2007. Dr. Mego is sitting next to me, comes to me and says, "We want to do Star Trek." So I said, "Gee, that's great." I mean, I knew. You know, we understand, there is a Mego convention. It's called MegoCon. It's held every year in June. It wasn't held last year, and won't be held this year. But we're going to try to push it out to September. We're not talking about tens of thousands of people that go. It's a hardcore 200-400 people who are Mego fanatics. Dr. Mego is one of the leaders of that convention. And him and another guy named Brian Hyland created something called the Mego Museum. It's an, I don't know if you've been on it, but it's a digital museum, and it talks about Mego across the board. So he comes to me and says, "We want to do Star Trek." I said, "Great, what's that going to do with me?" He says, "Well, we want to do it with you." I said, "Why would you want to do it with me?" He says, "Because with our..." Well, you tell him. Go ahead.
"Without Marty, it's not Mego. It's got to have Mego. It's got to have Marty involved."
So anyway, he turns around and says, "Let's go do it." And what happens is, he does with me, with Diamond Direct, I guess it was 100,000. How many thousand pieces we sold?
About
30,000. We sold about between 30,000 or 40,000 figures with me on the packaging promoting the brand. It was shocking because, you know, and that was the first inkling that I was going to do something. But what happened was I've had a pretty good career post-Mego. My team created the Power Glove. I don't know if you know what the Power Glove is, but that was the first virtual reality product. You put a glove on your hand and you could move projects in 3D space. It had an X, a Y, and a Z axis. Mm-hmm. All the head-mounted displays that you see now, we were doing back in the 90s, and we sold the Power Glove out of that head-mounted display concept to hook in with Nintendo. It was a $500 million piece of business. We did another brand called Skydancer, which is a flying doll where you pull a string and it flies up 40 feet in the air. I created that as well. That did about $700 million worth of business. So I've had in the product development area a pretty good career post Mego. I did not want to go back and get back into the Mego past, because to me it was something I held sacred and I didn't want to screw it up a second time. You know, losing it the first time was a disaster emotionally. Losing the second time would be horrific. And so, although we had this great success, not only, by the way, with Star Trek, but Paul also did with Diamond Planet of the Apes. And that was very, very, very successful as well. And, again, it helped me promoting the brand and making it work. But between that period of that 10-year period of time, when we did that, everybody was coming out with Mego-like product. In other words, they would create an action figure, they would dress it up, use the 14 points of articulation that we did, replicated it, and would call it Mego-like.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to a point where that just, over a 10-year period, broke me down. Sort of, okay, let's get back into the business. And that's what really, really pulled me back in, was everybody using, and I'm talking, there was several millions of dollars. I don't know if it's tens of millions, but millions of dollars of business were sold under the brand Mego-like. So I had to clean that all up. I had to get everybody out of the Mego-like. No one could say that any longer because we own the brand Mego. And that's how we got started. What brought me back into it. You know, the expression, I think Al Pacino said it best in The Godfather 3. When I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, Kenneth, in curating the section for the selection for Walmart's collectible section, how did Mego factor in?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, you know, Marty covered it really well. Mego is a classic, right? That form factor alone is an icon, and getting the real deal was really important, right? We didn't want any of that Mego-like stuff in there, right? And that the brand and the history gives so much credibility to building a collectible space, especially one focused on that adult collector, right? Because it's very much, they have that history and the nostalgia element. You know, and with that, you know, as we look at what Mego is and what they stand for and what they bring, like as we work with Marty and team, we really want to kind of celebrate the history of the brand and also use that classic form factor to bring like more contemporary characters to life. So kind of create these new takes on this classic, or a classic take on the new, right? And the, you know, the other thing that's really, really compelling about the Mego model is that the character design alone, right, with the common bodies and the ability to kind of just focus on the heads and the clothes and the hands allows for this unique kind of flexibility, so we can really create newness throughout like the year, which is really exciting. And it's something we haven't really had a chance to tap into yet, but I think that the opportunities as we keep going are really, really exciting.
Well, I mean, it's awesome as a collector, like especially in that Walmart collectible section, you know, that's popping up within the entertainment section at Walmart's. It's really cool to see like that Mego logo, and then something like, you know, like Marty, you had mentioned Star Trek, and Star Trek being, you know, an important IP in Mego's history, and now seeing figures for like Star Trek Discovery, right, and seeing like a show that's brand new, and seeing some of those characters, that are brand new to the Star Trek universe, and are, you know, brand new to people's 4K HDR, you know, TV sets, and then you see this, you know, very retro and perfectly vintage version of that figure. And I love that concept.
Well, and I think the packaging is such a unique piece as well. Like I'm a packaging geek, right? Like, so I get really focused on what it looks like on shelf. And with Mego, it's so kitschy and nostalgic. Like some of the packaging is like, this should not fly. Like it's almost in the goofy level, but it's just so on point for what Mego is, that it's like a little time machine, like on the shelf, right? Like it doesn't look like, you could almost picture like an old KB sticker on it. someone accidentally mm-hmm. put it in a new Walmart, and that's what's so much fun about it.
Yeah, there's something about the, I guess it's like the ratio to like of like bubble to card,
right?
That it. It, yeah, like your brain is like, huh? Like, but you know exactly what it is when you see it, and it does make it stand out. That's a really, really good point. So overall, how are people, and this kind of goes to everyone here. How are people, responding to the reintroduction of Mego, like the full, like we're back? How are people, responding to it?
From our point of view, it's been extraordinary. We basically started, 18 months ago, it came in 2018. That was specifically for one customer, and it was a crossover brand because we had to cut out a lot of the stuff that we knew was not Mego orientated. We're talking about when we first started delivering product was last spring and summer, and then the development was the 6 months prior to that. So the response has been just for us, as I said, it's been overwhelming. And then we created something called the Mego Ambassadors, and you know you got to start with one ambassador. So whoever that one ambassador was has exploded. Now we get like almost 9,200 Mego ambassadors worldwide, and we're on our way to this year. We should hope. Then the year we're close to 15,000, because it's not just Mego is not just a brand in the U.S., but it's branding and it's tracking in Canada obviously, but it's tracking in France and in England and Benelux and in Spain and in Germany. We just literally delivered China, which the Mego was never a brand in China, but. Because the way we're marketing it with all our crossover brands, so it's Planet of the Apes by Mego. It's Universal Monsters by Mego. It's Star Trek by Mego. It's all of this brand. And so when the market over there is accepting it in that strategy, the Chinese market's jumped. We just opened up the Japanese market, Australia. Two countries in South America, which are in dire straits financially because what's going on with COVID, what's going on in the world economy. Argentina and Brazil both have taken shipments this year and have reordered. So the sense of what this brand can be over the next 3 to 5 years is pretty extraordinary. And by the way, without the help and the leadership of Think Threefold, it would take us an extra 3 years to get there.
So we saw that superheroes and science fiction seem to be the two genres that Mego is really known for covering originally. Seems that horror is the new focus. So how have you selected the intellectual properties in Mego's modern era?
Interestingly enough, I'm going to let Kenneth handled that question because he's been a leader for us and has directed us in some of our best properties.
Yeah, this is definitely the fun part. As we look at like how the space came together, that they were building kind of for the adult collector, kind of going back to using the opportunity to introduce like iconic characters that aren't traditionally found in the kids aisle, right? Like, so we had a lot of fun this year with like Candyman and the Creeper from Jeepers Creepers, as well as a Teen Wolf. So these are like super fun icons that just have not been done in toy format a lot, right? And so horror is such a fun space. Done well, it's kind of like a schoolyard for adults, right? Like, you know, and historically in mass, it's been dominated by, you know, you've got 5 to 7 characters that have lived, that have just dominated, right? And I love Jason as much as the next, you know, horror geek, but, you know, I also go deeper than that. And what we've really started to uncover, that's not necessarily what people have been asking for, it's just what's been available, right? So most fans of like a Friday the 13th will also gladly purchase like a My Bloody Valentine or a Toxic Avenger because it's almost like a DNA thing. So kind of diving into that horror as a whole, it also has a lot of breadth to it that's mostly untapped. And that's where it really comes down to finding those unique characters that just haven't been done, that Mego can kind of be the first in an out kind of exciting way. A lot of it's untapped because a ton of the content was low budget and there was no licensing or merchandising deals even considered, you know, until now as licensing agencies are kind of gathering stuff up. And what we're seeing is when we drop an unexpected character, like when it gets out into the wild, fans go nuts, right? Like, so it's really fun to see. My favorite comment is like, I can't believe they made that. Why would they make that? Right? Like, that's just so much fun. We are looking, beyond horror. We do have, basically the way we have it kind of coordinated in stores is they have a horror specific slot and then like an entertainment specific slot. So it kind of gives us a little bit of flexibility, and entertainment is where you see things like Ultraman and Star Trek and things like that. So it's still, you're going to see both. But the ability to actually focus on horror is, I think, going to create a really nice divide in character assortment and IP selection, like as it just keeps going.
Yeah, I have to say that obviously the news that Mego was coming back was exciting because of the legacy of the brand and everything. But I have to say the four that like really caught my attention, and I'm so happy to now have all four of these actually. So Ultraman, because I mean, come on, it's perfect. Like if there was ever a thing that should have been a Mego toy when Ultraman was out, was Ultraman.
Yeah, when we talked about that one, I was actually taken aback that they had never done that before. Right.
I Googled it because I was like, wow, this looks like it looks like it should have been, it looked like a reproduction of something that should have already been a Mego figure. Like that's how good that the like brand alignment was on that one.
That's right.
So Ultraman, Mask of the Red Death.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, Phantom of the Opera, iconic film, but like a deep pull from... from that movie. I mean, just unbelievable. And then Hammer Dracula, because you can never have enough Christopher Lee in toy form ever. And by the way, I love that you guys are bringing Van Helsing, Peter Cushing's Van Helsing next. Very, 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 very excited for that one. And then the last one was Hannibal Lecter, and not just one Hannibal Lecter, but two different Hannibal Lecters, complete with the mask, complete with the straitjacket. Like, just again, like to your point, like four figures where it's like, I can't believe that these exist, period, but that they exist in 2021.
Yeah, like I'm excited that, I have Candyman. Like, I would have never thought that there would have been a Candyman figure, and now I'm like, well, who else can we get, and can there be more? Like,
yeah,
it got me even more fired up for the new movie that's come.
Interesting enough, to give you a quick take on Ultraman. Ultraman has got the classic Ultraman, but so, there have been so many subsequent Ultramans over the years that we're going to be bringing out, as well as their evil, alien, miserable people.
Who? They're called Kaiju. Yeah, the Kaiju.
Paul's telling me that they're called Kaiju.
Yep, there you go.
So I was searching for that word as all these other things came out. But what interesting enough, Ultraman is like Star Wars to here. Ultraman is the same way in China. Forget about Japan. Japan has run its course over the last X amount of years. It's over and over and over. And so literally in Japan, we call the resting time. But in China, because the culture has been so attuned to it, and they've had nothing like it, it has just exploded for us in China. So which will give us the ability to make this brand much wider and deeper than if it was just, we're going to do our selections here, because we'd roll them up. But now, because of the manufacturing capabilities, we can do 8-10 different characters and build around the process. And one of the things we started to think about, and is to do some unique environments.
Mm.
I don't know if you guys remember the Bridge of the Enterprise, but when we launched that, we sold 850,000 pieces. And the key thing was the magic, literally the magic of the transporter room. Now, I have seen that particular mechanism in 30 or 40 different items over the last 30 years, replicating it, trying to accommodate what we've accomplished with that. But it never had the imagination of what we created, where you spin it out and it was gone. Where'd it go? Well, that's the other planet. That's not the, I mean, it was back to the back door. You had to pull it out, but it went down to the bridge of the Romulan spaceship. So we're in the process of building that. I don't know if you remember the treehouse for the Planet of the Apes. We sold, I mean, that was one, the year that we launched it, that sold 40, that one item, 40% of the category. Everybody who bought a figure bought the treehouse. It was just, in terms of, and that launched the whole area of, especially in preschool, treehouses for the younger kid. My point is, we know that there are play environments that we can bring out that can be very unique, especially now when we do limited quantities, and that's again our plan across the board. So, as we start to look towards the future, it's not just the characters, but the environments that we can put these characters in, and create almost a universe, an echo universe of characters, environments. And other paraphernalia that brings in the whole Mego brand.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome, because I'm sure you guys are all very well aware of the online community that has been built up over people just kind of showing off their toy displays, or of course, toy photography, and having those, what are effectively, at the end of the day, play sets, but really they end up becoming diorama pieces. And
well, that's exactly what they are. Yes.
And people love building these elaborate displays and taking these, professional level, having professional level photography sessions with action figures and play sets. And I think that's an incredible idea. Very exciting one too.
Well, I'll tell you, after Paul will talk to you afterwards, he'll send you some of the videos that we've been making. Exactly down that road, to give you an idea of some of the things that we may be doing over the next 3 to 5 years.
Amazing.
For sure.
So we have one question for you before we get into, we have a little Q&A where we put out an Instagram story asking our followers if they had any questions for you, and we have a few. But one last question before we get into that. Out of all of the brands and intellectual properties, that you guys have worked with over the years, and there have been a ton, is there one that you would love to take a stab at that you haven't yet?
You gotta be kidding.
Just one. Just pick. You could say, if you
you know the answer to that. You know the answer to that.
I mean, I think I do.
If you don't know the answer to it, I'm not going to give it to you.
Does it rhyme with bar chores?
Well, you're close. Well, you know, I mean, you know it. I mean, that was, that's always been a thing. I've gone to them 20 different ways because I had a whole marketing strategy. It's called a what if.
Yeah.
And what if we did it versus them doing it? And how we would have approached it. Because remember, they didn't come out with that brand for almost a year after the movie left, because they had to go out and rebuild the tooling from scratch.
Yep.
We would have been out with that product literally when the movie was still in the theaters.
Yeah. And I mean, talk about what if. I mean, that would have completely upended and rewritten the history of toys and action figures. I mean, like, geez, that, I mean, you're talking like, I don't know if you guys have been following Varner Studios, the great sculptors on Instagram. They've done a lot of work for Playmates toys over the years. And they're showing off a lot of the sculpts that they actually produced in the early 90s when they were also when Playmates was vying for the brand, before the eventual Kenner Hasbro relaunch. But, I would love, I don't know if you guys can share any of it at this point, but it would be amazing to see like some of the stuff that you would have mocked up and like to see those characters in that format. Like, it'd be so cool.
Close your eyes.
Okay.
And make your imagination, because we did nothing.
Oh, I'm sitting here actually closing my eyes, waiting for like the next thing. And yeah.
You're sitting in the store theater.
Exactly. Exactly. not with like the characters wouldn't have had like yellow lightsabers. They would have been the right colors and originally. Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, that would have been absolutely out of this world. Wild stuff. Yeah.
Also hashtag bar chores.
Yeah, bar chores. All right, Dave, do you want to kick us off with the, sometimes I have my moments, man. Sometimes I have my moments. Put that on a t-shirt. So Dave, do you want to kick us off with the Q&A?
I sure can. And I have a handle that I can actually, phonetically read this time. So at Eric Von Eric, asks, and spelled the same way as Eric co-hosting this show, would you consider returning to the 1970s style of packaging for figures?
Yes.
Well, there you go.
There he is.
There you go, fellow Eric. I love this. All right. Easy. Next one. I gave myself a difficult one here. At W. Yarmel. Yeah, we're going to go with that. At W.
That looks right.
W. Yarmel asks, when can we expect to see final shots of the new Planet of the Apes figures?
Cornelius and Dr. Zaius are already in stores. So the next two are Caesar and General Ursus, and they'll be showing up in the next week or so.
Awesome. So far, you guys are just two for two with like giving people what they want. Dave, keep us going.
At 3D Movie Man asks, would you love to see something like Mr. Barlow from Salem's Lot? Has that franchise been on your radar?
Yeah. Yes. It's the vampire from Salem's Lot looks like Nosferatu.
Yes.
So yes. We didn't want to do that. Yeah, we didn't want to jump into that. We just did Nosferatu. But further down the road, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that all of those Stephen King licenses, like there's so many good characters. In reading that question, I'm just thinking of like all of the fun, like a Creepshow line would be awesome with like mossy, like a mossy flocked version of Stephen King from Creepshow. While we're talking about Creepshow and Stephen King,
yeah, Jordy Verrill is another topic that we
we keep going back to. Oh man! All right, Dave, I think that was the last one.
I think it was.
Yeah. All right. You guys survived the fire round of Instagram questions. So we kind of touched on this a little bit before we got into the Q&A, but before we wrap it up, outside of building environments for these toys and these characters to live in, what's on the horizon for Mego? Is there anything else that you have in the works coming up that you guys can share?
No, I mean, obviously we have a string of stuff that's happening, which includes a range of different sizes and positions, but we can't tell you that yet because we're filtering through it now, and quite candidly, we got to sit down with Kenneth and get some of his input in the direction on finalization. But we're playing out now all the way through 2023.
Wow.
that's the depth of both character involvement as well as brand extensions and not just brand extensions, but brand verticalization and what that means and how we're going to be doing some stuff. We can visit and do one of these podcasts every 6 months, and we'll give you updates of what's happening, so you get a sense of what the last one said. And here's where we are now. We alluded to it, but we didn't tell you about it.
So, I mean, if that's you agreeing to come on this podcast as a regular guest every 6 months, we're so game for that. That's like let's put it in the calendar now. Like,
yes, please.
But you guys did announce you're bringing back the 14-inch scale figures, right? Those are that announcement.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exciting. Well, I can't wait to see those in person. Dave, so this brings us to our final question. Would you like to put on your James Lipton hat and bring us on home?
Yes. Now, Kenneth, you answered this last time. But before we let you go, Paul and Marty, we finish every interview with this last question. And it could be either one or both. So keep that in mind. What is your favorite and or strangest piece in your collection?
I know my pieces. I've got a single piece, only one in the world, and that's because my brother lost his piece. But out of an original Planet of the Apes head, my father molded for both of us, because you know he lived in Hong Kong for 15 years running the factories. A solid gold Planet of the Apes Caesar head. It's just so cool.
Mm-hmm. Actually, my strangest piece is an 8-inch Marty Abrams.
Okay.
Okay.
Is your 8-inch Marty Abrams mint on card, though?
No, it's loose. It's running around my house loose.
All right. I would love to see the golden head if you ever are able to share a picture of that. I'd love to share it.
I have not shown it to anybody outside of people who come to the house, because if that's what happens is all of a sudden that becomes world. First of all, the gold itself is, because gold has gone so high, but the other side of it is it's one of a kind. In that context. So I don't even tell the people about it. You guys are so cool that I figured I'd give you a little insight about something that no one else knows about.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for entrusting us with that. That share. That is an awesome story, and it's an awesome piece. Before we let you guys go, just let us know where can we find you on the internet? Where can we learn more about Mego, and where can we learn more about Think Threefold?
Well, MegoFigures.com, MegoMuseum.com, and Facebook, Mego Ambassadors. There's a Mego Corp Facebook page, but Mego Ambassadors is the most fun. It's a lot of interaction between fans.
Yes, the Mego community is an awesome one to poke around in, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Kenneth, remind us, where can we hook up with Think Threefold on the interwebs?
So we're on Instagram under Collection Obsession Official, and then we have a website, collectionobsession.com. That's where you can find out what's coming. We're posting stuff all the time, and we interact with people regularly and directly. And then, of course, a lot of our stuff is at walmart.com/collectibles is where you see a lot of it. There's even a Mego showcase up right now that has some exclusive items, and it even has that Ultraman on there. So if you don't have one, it's a good way to get it.
and if you guys want to, if listeners out there, you want to get a little bit of an idea of, hands-on with a Mego figure and you haven't yet, you can check out our review of three different Mego figures. We'll put the link to that in the description. And we have that up on our YouTube as well. They are awesome. As if you couldn't tell, we liked them before listening to this entire show. Let me assure you, they're super cool figures. So Marty, Paul, Kenneth, thank you guys so much for joining us on Adventures in Collecting. You guys have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, dear listener, for hanging out with us today. Subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen, and then tell your friends to do it. Thanks also to Joe Azari, the golden voice behind our intro. Our music is Game Boy Horror by the Zombie Dandies. Find more about them both in our show notes.
Follow us on social media at AIC_podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Stop by and say hi, show us your toy hauls, and share your toy stories. Maybe we'll talk about it in a future episode.
Don't try this at home. Void where prohibited and some assembly required. Each sold separately, not a flying toy. Consult a physician if your toy run exceeds more than 4 hours.
This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.